Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. My guest today is Mike McNichol, who for the past 9 months has been the director of the Clatsop County Health and Human Services Department. The department provides a diverse range of services to the county's 37,000-plus residents, from family planning to immunizations, restaurant inspections to disaster preparedness, and many more in between. Among other challenges facing the department, Mike will address the syphilis outbreak going on now in the county and plans to introduce a syringe exchange program for intravenous drug users to prevent the spread of bloodborne disease. Before accepting the top post within the Health Department, Mike previously served as the department's Environmental Services Supervisor. He holds a master's degree in public health from Oregon Health and Science University. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Mike.
Oh, thank you, Joan. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
To start off, I'd like to just ask you a general question, and that is that we live in such a beautiful area. It's rural. It would seem to be safe and safe from disease. Do we face the same problems here that people in larger communities such as Portland and Seattle do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the syphilis example is a great one, that syphilis is still a problem throughout Oregon, but it's particularly bad in more of the urban areas such as Portland, Hillsboro, Beaverton. But Highway 26 is a corridor that we're finding that how syphilis is traveling up and down. And the epidemiology suggests that the connection between intravenous drug users and heroin addiction and syphilis is pretty close. So the same sort of problems that they experience in the urban areas of Multnomah County with overdose of heroin and opioids and all that is still effective out here on the coast. So that's a great example. In the environmental areas, you know, we don't have the urban problems that they do there, like bad air pollution and things like that. But we still have some issues we have to address here. But really, we do, from a communicable disease standpoint, the same diseases that affect them affect us.
And say a little bit more about the syphilis outbreak in particular here. How many numbers are you seeing this year compared with previous years?
Sure. So back a few months ago, I worked with the state epidemiology department. And what was happening is we were showing an increase in incidence and prevalence of the number of cases of syphilis in our county. So working with them, they did agree that we were seeing, quote, an outbreak. Now, you know, when you talk about prevalence numbers, you're talking about numbers in per 100,000. So well, the percentage is not that high. The number of cases was going way up. So, you know, we had 8 cases last year, and we're going to break that number this year. I can't really say because it's only June, but we've had at least 5 cases so far. And what we're doing actually to address this is we're taking a really proactive stance. We decided that in order to find the cases, we have outreach clinics. And we had an outreach clinic at the Providence Seaside Hospital. We've had that one for a couple months. We have one in our Story Clinic on Exchange Street. And then we've been doing outreach in the jail. So what happens is we go there once a week, and we invite through the jail nurses the number of people who would be interested in having a blood test to see if they're getting screened for not just syphilis, but HIV, gonorrhea, and chlamydia at the same time. So we're really trying to do a bunch of different things at once. And when we do that, just yesterday, we saw 20 people in the jail and took 20 blood samples. And that's a huge day for us. Now, we won't have those results for a couple of days. But what we found, though, is since the beginning of our outreach, the numbers were going up. As of the last 2 weeks, we've had no new cases. So
that's
either
great.
Yeah, it's we'll take the credit. I'm not sure if we can, but we will. So yeah, that's a great example. I also want to share that the effectiveness of the program goes beyond just treatment, identification and treatment. We actually had a case in the jail of a male who was tested and found he had syphilis, who then told the nurse that his girlfriend was pregnant and she may not know her status as syphilis. So we tracked her down. She happened to be a jail inmate in Clark County, Washington, tracked her down, had her tested. She was positive too and pregnant. So in fact, we actually treated three people out of the two, and we actually may have prevented a congenital case of syphilis, which is always fatal.
So the baby should be fine then?
The baby should be fine.
Okay. And what is the best way to prevent syphilis?
The best way is to avoid bloodborne pathogens or contact with, kind of blood fluids. So, safe sex practices, condom use. And, if you are an intravenous drug user, you should not use dirty needles because that's how it's another way you can get it.
Well, that gets into another question that I wanted to ask
sure.
you about. And that is the syringe exchange program that is in the works.
Yes.
Could you say more about that?
Sure. So beginning last year, when I became director, I was noticing it's not news to anyone that we have a pretty serious heroin epidemic in our county, as worth everywhere. As opioid use increased throughout the 2000s, and now that they're clamping down on opioid use, the problem is as opioid use goes down, heroin use goes up, because the same people who are addicted to opioids are also having to, without getting proper addiction treatment services, they turn to a less expensive alternative to have the same high. So what we decided to do is in order to address the communicable disease piece is that, and looking at some peer review materials from the World Health Organization, Multnomah County, the National Institutes of Health, that it was time to actually think about doing a syringe exchange to try to stem the tide of our communicable disease. And also with intravenous drug use, it's not just communicable disease, but there's also cases of endocarditis, which can also be fatal.
And why is that?
It's an inflammation of the heart. So you can have heart trouble. You can also have a lot of skin abscesses and a lot of skin issues. The goal here is to do, so we can, instead of calling it a syringe exchange, we call it a harm reduction program, because it really is about harm reduction. We're trying to move people from using dirty needles, sharing them amongst them, to using clean needles, and also at the same time refer them to addiction services if they wish. Also explain safer sex practices and giving them options for that, and really try to change that culture into being a little more safe and reduce the harm. So I started with working with the Human Services Advisory Committee, which advises the county manager and the board about things. And I sort of drafted a plan, and I've been meeting with local law enforcement. All the chiefs have been informed, and I've spoken to them personally. I've also spoken to the sheriff and the district attorney, and most of them are either, there's no opposition, but they're not going to publicly, give endorsements. But, there is a recognition that we do have a pretty serious problem. We have to do something. I also plan to working and partnering with Jordan's Hope, and trying to get some help there. And the program we're going to pilot it for the first year, and it's not going to take any taxpayers' money at all. We have a donation that's coming that we're going to use it for that pilot, and we're going to do as many. The plan is to have a couple of public health nurses go to different parts of the county and preordained places and exchange needles, probably on a one-for-one basis, and also give them materials on addiction treatment services and other harm reduction things. And we're going to pilot that for a year and see how it goes.
Okay. Is there an age limit on who can use the service? Say a teenager under 18, since obviously these are illegal drugs.
Sure.
And they're minors, which exacerbates the problem.
Right. So, the state law does not prohibit the exchange of needles. It's not against the law. And so we're not really going to be checking ID for age. So, it's going to be assuming that the person comes in good faith to exchange needles for their own use. We're going to try to make sure that even if it's a teenager that they're going to use the needle safely. So, and exchange one for the old one from the new one, so they don't pass it around within their own group.
Okay. And where will you have the actual exchange place?
Yeah, so right now we haven't quite decided that yet, but we know we want definitely one in Astoria, in the city of, somewhere where most of the maybe where some folks congregate, also out in the county, probably the Napa-Swenson area, maybe otherwhere. We don't really know yet because we want to kind of, what I've been doing also is doing a survey in the jail of the people who claim to be, who actually admit using IV drugs, and trying to get an idea geographically where they would go. The last time I did that survey, I found that of the folks who said they were IV drug users, 100% of them said they would use a service, and they would travel long distances to actually exchange needles.
Wow, so there they is are some concerned.
They are. So they do know that there is a pretty serious problem with it. So that, to me, that means they recognize that dirty needles are not safe. So I think that there's a lot of need in the community, and there's, so we're trying to gear up, you know, there's a few, factors we haven't quite, we won't know until we try, right? We don't know how many people use exactly and how many needles there are out there that we want to get rid of. So some of those are kind of factors we'll have to work on as we move forward.
Will there be any charge to the users?
No charge.
And, do you have any idea how many needles you might see returned in a given year?
Ooh, that's a good question. So we did speak to, about 2 weeks ago, I spoke to Outside In from Multnomah County, and they're the contractor who does their needle exchange in Multnomah County. And at the peak of their, so they go every week out to their various places. And at the one of the biggest exchanges they had, they exchanged 60,000 needles.
In a year?
No, in a day.
In a day?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I almost fell on my chair when I heard that. Anyway, you know, they experience about 35 to 45,000 needles a week that they're trying to exchange. And to me, that just blows my mind, because that would be a mountain, literally, of needles. So, you know, I don't think, you know, their population's far superior in size, 20 times bigger. So I don't think we'll see that many. I really can't say. I know there's been a pent-up need. We do see and have heard of needles being in our public areas and dugouts and in playgrounds and all over the place. What I'm hoping, though, is when we pass out the needles, we're also going to give them a sharps disposal container so they can properly dispose of their sharps. And hopefully they'll do that, and they can give us their containers as well as exchange needles. So there will be some safety. Also, it won't be like folks come up, hand the nurses, you know, needles with the needle exposed.
Right.
They're going to have to put it in a container, and then we'll just exchange it that way. That's the only way we can be safe.
Of course.
And if that community, you know, it is a community. IV drug users are a community. Apparently, they are well connected with each other. Through the surveys, we found that everybody kind of knows what's going on. That community is going to hopefully take it upon themselves to make sure we start disposing of these things appropriately, and we'll see a reduction in the places we see all the needles in our public places, reducing the risk for those kids who might accidentally get stuck. That's one of the bigger goals for us too, is not just harm reduction for the individual who uses IV drugs, but also for the poor innocent kid who just happens to be playing in the baseball field who steps on a needle. I mean, that'd be horrible. So
has that happened?
We've had needle sticks. I haven't heard of any here, but we wouldn't get those reports. They'd probably go to the emergency department. So, you know, that's not something we would know. But, you know, the police, when we spoke to some of the sheriff's folks who do the drug interventions, you know, they go into homes and there's hundreds and hundreds, maybe even thousands of needles laying around.
Oh, geez.
And that's something we need to work on. So I think if we can get that out of control, that's our secondary goal, right, is to try to get these out of the circulation and out of the way of our public places. So
when the people come to exchange their needles, the police know that these are IV drug users. They may well have heroin or other illegal drugs on themselves. Do the police just agree to look the other way?
Yeah, so I think what we're doing, part of the goal of this harm reduction is we'd have to do some very careful messaging about what we want to do. And the messaging is going to be when we start through our social media outlets, is that do not bring drug paraphernalia to these at all. We can't control what the police may or may not do. We do have some assurances that they won't interfere, But if you're purposely coming to the place, then exchanging drugs at these places, then we're sort of going to get it. We're going to get to a point where then those who say we're enabling, then, you know, you could make the case that that's not exactly the thing we want to do. And I don't want that to happen. I want it to be, you come there to exchange needles, no questions asked. You move on, you get some information, education, and you go about your way and do what you're going to do. But you're not going to exchange drugs at these locations. That's not what this is about. This is about trying to reduce the chances of getting a communicable disease. If you get HIV, it's for life. If you get hepatitis C, it's an $80,000 fix. So, you know, we as a society, we've got to do something about this. And the way we can reduce the harm and the cost of society overall is doing this. You know, we're going to have some cooperation from that community to self-police and make sure that doesn't happen.
I would think it would be in their own best interest.
I would think so, yeah.
If you're just joining me, you are listening to a pre-recorded interview with Clatsop County's Health and Human Services Director, Mike McNichol. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio. What do you say to some people who might argue that such a program condones illegal drug use?
Sure. So how I would answer that is this. The public health, as with all governmental entities, do not condone intravenous drug use at all. We don't condone that. But my job as a public health director and as a public health professional is to assure the community is that my community is free of communicable disease. So even though public health may not condone the use of intravenous drugs is what's causing a communicable disease. So my job is to intervene in that. And even though we are exchanging needles and trying to do harm reduction, there in no way do we intend on or condone the use of those drugs. But public health is not addiction services either. So what we want to make sure is that when somebody comes to that and they are in a position in their life where they want to get treatment, we'll be offered the opportunity to have that referral process. So even though you could argue that, you know, exchanging needles may be something that we condone, it is not. I want to be real clear that public health does not condone that. But my charge is to make sure that we eliminate communicable disease to the degree possible. And this is the one way we can. The National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organizations, and a myriad of peer-reviewed articles have proven that this is one way to be very effective in reducing communicable disease such as HIV, hepatitis C, and syphilis. And as a community, we need to do those things because we do have those here.
Okay. Thank you. I want to shift gears a bit, and I'm curious, what drew you to public health?
Yeah, so that's a good story. So actually, when I went to school at Western Washington University back in the early 90s, I actually wanted to be a teacher at the time, but I took a class in ecology, and I kind of just fell into interest in that time because it was the environmental movement was strong in the early 90s, and I didn't really have an environmental bent, but I was more interested in public health as, you know, as it turned into water quality issues. That's really my passion, is water quality. And the opportunity came in at Kitsap County Public Health Department, which is located in Bremerton, Washington. They had a position open up as a solid waste inspector. So my job was to go around to people's property and tell them to clean up the junk. And that's what I did for a while. And then I got an opportunity to branch out a little bit and do more on-site septic services work, water quality, and a lot of other things. And I just sort of built it up from there and worked into food and food protection and food safety and a whole bunch of other things. And so that's basically started over 24 years ago, working in the small solid waste program, moving into this. And I just have a passion for public health. I think it's one of the programs that really has, I saw a statistic yesterday that of the 30 years that people have gained in lifespan from the 1900s to 2000, that 25 of those years in life gain is due to public health.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's impressive. Who are the typical clients of your department?
Sure. So we have a lot of different clients. So in the immunization program, we mostly do children of immunization age trying to go to school because, you know, in order to get into certain schools, you have to have your immunizations up to speed. For family planning, we see teenagers as well as adults of all ages, both male and female. And then in the communicable disease program, we see folks from, you know, every walk of life. And so that's sort of who the clientele is, you know. And public health is not the difference between public health and private health. Public health is we treat everybody; the whole community is our patient. Private health is a one-on-one treating that person one-on-one. So we look at it. You know, that's why we do epidemiology as our science that we use. We look at prevalence and incidence of cases, and then try to do interventions to reduce those things. So that's the difference. And our clients, we really aren't treated as a primary care because we don't have any primary care providers. We really focus on public health issues.
Okay, but that was a question I was going to ask. Are you essentially a primary care provider for a number of your clients who may not have insurance?
No, we don't provide any primary care unless it's family planning related or women's health. If there's, so for example, if a woman comes in for a family planning service, if there's other issues that present themselves, our family planning provider will then refer them along to other places to get those services. So, yeah, we don't perform those kind of things there.
Okay. Do you charge for your services?
Well, that's a good question. So it's a complicated one. So if someone doesn't have any insurance at all, we do slide the scale down so they can get those services. We do try to, you know, we are still a government entity and we still have to pay the bills, keep the lights on. So we do try to bill as often as we can. But we're also sensitive to the income levels of folks. And so we try to make sure that the level of income meets the services they need are somewhere met. And then if we can bill, we will.
Okay. You mentioned teenagers come into the department for family planning.
Yes.
Is there an age limit at which they no longer have to notify their parents? I'm not sure what the law is in Oregon.
Yeah. So basically, we have, if a client comes in, no matter what their age is, the HIPAA law applies. So we can't really notify anybody. So it's a privacy issue.
Okay. So in other words, they don't have to notify their parents.
No.
Okay. All right. What other needs do you see facing the department and the county as a whole, public health-wise?
Sure. You know, so I think this is sort of philosophy that I have that, you know, the acute diseases that we've seen and that's affected the American population since 1900 to 2000, you know, we've really done a great job on acute diseases, things that are immediately.
Such, what kind of disease?
Acute diseases would be like pneumonia, tetanus, pertussis, those kind of things that are immediately, you get it, you get sick, and you could die.
We have immunizations,
right, and we have sanitation, we have all those things. Now we're really suffering a problem from chronic disease, you know, obesity, heart disease, stroke, those kind of things. And so public health, we've been really great at the acute disease piece. We're going to have to change focus as our demographic of America changes from, is getting older, the chronic disease problem is going to also increase. So we're going to have to, as a public health professionals, start looking at how are we going to best deal with the chronic disease while still keeping an eye on our syphilis and TB cases. We just had another TB case happen this past couple of weeks.
Tuberculosis.
Really? It has not gone away. It's still here.
That was a disease of the 19th century.
Yeah, and it's still back. And it's still active in our community. And
what do you think contributes to that?
I think there's... It's ironic, the two cases we get, the people who traveled overseas probably contracted there and then came over here and got it.
And it's highly contagious, isn't it?
It can be contagious during certain periods of time. It's not always contagious. TB also is kind of a tricky, there's windows of opportunity for when that organism is most contagious, mostly when people are actively coughing and they have tuberculosis. So you can actually have TB and not actually have any symptoms, and you can also go long periods of time without any. So, but those are kind of things that we've been really good at dealing with, right? We identify the case, we treat everybody around it, and we move on. The chronic disease like obesity and heart disease and those kind of things, what's going to have to happen is public health is going to have to reach way back in time and start at some point with the kids to make sure that the chronic diseases don't happen in the future. So we have to do a lot of upstream work. That's what's going to have to happen in healthy living and wellness. Otherwise, we're just really not going to make any strides, because by the time you present at 65 years old with obesity, chronic heart disease, and all these other chronic conditions, a lot of the water's passed under the bridge for where we can actually do something. So then you become an acute case simply because of the chronic condition. So, so public health has to work on how are we going to do that. We did a great job with tobacco, right? Tobacco prevention. There's 450,000 people died per year. That number's continually dropped over the decades.
What percentage smoke now? Do you know?
In Oregon, it's around 18% still.
But that number's
dropping.
Better.
But you can see that the numbers continue to drop, especially among teenagers. That number continues to go down. So there is some success with tobacco. But we need to do that kind of upstream work with like obesity and other wellness issues.
Aside from the fact that we are living longer, what else do you think contributes to these chronic diseases, the rise in them, such as obesity and stroke and heart disease?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, people's, we're becoming more sedentary as a population. I think that sometimes the food availability that we have can also contribute heavily. You know, it's a lot easier to and cheaper to go to McDonald's than it is to go to your local grocery store and make your own food, although the price actually over time is cheaper. But the immediacy of that is what's probably, you know, if you have a screaming family of four in the back of the car, you can go through McDonald's, bam, done.
You've been working all day, you're tired.
Exactly. So, you know, convenience has now made it where obesity is gonna happen. You know, lack of exercise, those kind of things really are playing a huge role in it. And so we really need to continue to focus on the kids, making them, you know, help them decide what's a good choice and what isn't by providing them with evidence of the data. So, you know, public health relies on evidence-based data. So, you know, it's a constant battle trying to make people realize the two choices, either McDonald's or the healthy fruit and vegetable alternative. You know, those two things are often difficult to get across, but, you know, it becomes down to that a chronic disease is not something that happens overnight. So it's hard to make those choices early on in life. And that's where you have to really focus on, is really making sure people, if they do these things, they can actually prolong their lives and be much healthier later on.
Do you foresee public health then going into the schools to educate kids?
We do now, actually. We have public health nurses who go in and talk about stuff like that. You know, going into the schools is always a tricky situation, because there's a lot of, you know, depends on what your curriculum is and timing and all that stuff. So I think that we're going to have to at least partner with all the schools to make sure that they have some lessons on, you know, diet choices and healthy behaviors and that kind of things. And I think that some of that's already happening, but, you know, it's really about constant reminders, because you go watch television, you get flooded with commercials about, you know, food products that may not be good for you and all these other things. And public health has not always been the best at marketing. So the social marketing piece is something we really need to focus on, is how do we market to the same level that the marketing geniuses on Wall Street are. We need to be able to social market different messages just as well as they do.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Mike. It's been really enlightening for me. Unfortunately, though, we are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Mike McNichol, for coming into the studio to discuss health issues affecting Clatsop County. Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Mike is the director of the Clatsop County Health and Human Services Department that serves the entire county and its 37,000-plus residents. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. Perspectives was engineered today by Kate Brister. The show can be heard every other Friday on the stations of Coast Community Radio. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. Thanks for listening.